My name is Glenn. If you don't know me, thank you for coming to Chi Alpha. It's great to have you here tonight. If you thought this was that humanities movie that someone thought was showing here tonight, it's not, although I am a human, and I will move. And so feel free. I'm sure if you say your professor will give you full credit for that. We're launching a new series this week. We just finished taking a five-week look at the book of Psalms with our series, Put a Song in Your Heart. Psalms are at the heart of the Bible, both literally and metaphorically. And by looking at those, we got a real sense of God's heart for us and what our heart for God should be. Now we're going to spend the next few weeks looking at some heroes of the faith in a series that I'm calling Running with the Giants. It was inspired by the title of a book that I saw once that I've never read. So if you've read the book and I've got nothing to do with that, well, my apologies, but I'm glad this isn't plagiarism. Just creative borrowing. But Running with Giants, the idea is that God put all these stories in the Bible to help us, to give us wisdom and insight into how we ought to live our lives today. And so we're going to take a look over the next few weeks at a few of the key heroes in the Bible. This week we're going to take a look at Esther in a message I'm calling I'm Too Sexy for My Faith. Next week we're taking a look at Jacob with Heads I Win, Tail You Lose. Then the week after that we're taking a look at Deborah, Judge Judy meets Joan of Arc. After that, the Apostle Paul, I Believe, Therefore I Am. And finally, the Apostle John, Jesus loves you, but I'm his favorite. And so we're going to take one courtesy laugh at least. I really get a kick out of it. I think that's hilarious. But then again, I'm just a disturbed, sad little man. But tonight we're going to take a look at Esther. Esther is a story in the Bible that as soon as I reference the book, everybody thinks they know what I'm going to talk about. Right away, people think that they're going to hear this phrase. Does anybody know it? For such a time as this. That is not at all what I want to talk about. Esther is a biblical hero, and God has done some neat things through her in this story. Incidentally, Book of Esther, I've been told, is, according to many Jews, the most popular book in the Old Testament worldwide. They just love reading it, probably because it's associated with the Feast of Purim, which is sort of the Jewish equivalent of Mardi Gras, a real wild party time. But it's also an exceptionally well-crafted story. If you've never read the Book of Esther in a while, you really need to pick it up and dig through it. It's very short, taking maybe 20 minutes. It's really, really well written. But tonight, I want to do something a bit unusual. Instead of focusing on Esther's virtues and the things that made her a hero, I want to talk about some of her flaws. All the heroes in the Bible save Jesus have got significant flaws to them. Esther is like them. She's got some rather major shortcomings in her life, and tonight I want to take a look at one that I think probably most of us wrestle with to a greater or lesser degree. To help you see what the flaw in her life is, by the way, Esther, I in no way mean to cast disparagement on you for my message tonight. By the way, didn't Esther do a great job leading worship tonight? Yes. Woo! Thank you. Figured I should build her up before I say some unkind things about her namesake. So to give you a context or help you understand why it is that Esther had a few key flaws, I'm going to give you sort of a historical background on where she fits. The Bible can be broken down into a couple of main chunks, the Old Testament at least. You've got the primeval history. This would be the creation of the world through the Tower of Babel. Through the Tower of Babel. After that, you've got the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and their wanderings finally over into Egypt with Joseph. And the Egyptian captivity that ensues, read about that. Actually, you don't really read about that. You sort of skipped over in the Bible. Pick it up again with Moses in the Exodus. And then you read about their exodus from Egypt in the first five books of the Bible, the Pentateuch. Finally, they arrive in the Promised Land. You have the time of the judges. Israel develops a monarchy. You've got the time of the kings. The kings are wicked. They are not good kings. And God judges Israel by allowing them to be captured by pagan nations. And the exile begins. You hear about the exile in such books as Daniel and in Esther. You also see part of the return begin in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. And then many of the prophets are scattered about in this time frame as well, giving advice to Israel and their time in captivity. So the book of Esther falls right down here into the middle. It's one of the last chronological book in the Bible, with the exception of Ezra and Nehemiah. And in case you happen to be Italian, Malachi here caps things off with his, it's Malachi, if you're not Italian, caps things off with his final prophecy. After that, we got 400 and so years of silence until Jesus comes on the scene, or John the Baptist comes on the scene. So Esther falls right in here. What happens in her life is that she's happening about 100 years after Daniel and his friends were first captured and brought to Babylon. Empires have changed, gone from Babylon to the Medo-Persian Empire. Don't worry, this isn't all boring history stuff. Gone from Babylon to the Medo-Persian Empire. About 100 years after that, about 30 years before Nehemiah goes back. So they've had a long time to get good and settled in living in captivity, and to begin to sort of back off from some of the essentials of their faith. Esther, from all we can tell in the Bible, along with her uncle Mordecai, is not a particularly religious Jew. She's like most Jewish people that you meet in America today. She's Jewish by heritage, but not so much by lifestyle. And how can I demonstrate that to you? Well, let me tell you the book of Esther and how it flows. It begins with a man named Ahasuerus. History-wise, you probably know him better as King Xerxes. King Xerxes, the guy who tried to invade Greece. You may remember this. Well, anyway, King Xerxes is trying to build up momentum for his invasion of Greece. His father tried to do so, hadn't gone so well, so he's trying to rally the troops, and so he does this big 6-month-long celebration, trying to show people all his wealth and splendor and majesty and how wonderful and powerful of a king he is. So when he says, hey, let's go kick some Greek tail, they're like, yes, let's go do it. And so he's trying to rally the troops. And so he's praying out. Everyone is drinking from a pure gold goblet that's different from the person next to them. Ornate, elaborate, ostentatious wealth. At the climax of the feast, he decides to bring out his wife, the most beautiful woman in the kingdom, Queen Vashti, to stand before his people. And he's bringing out as one more thing, another thing that he owns to show how great of a guy he is. And so she says no. Now, she probably did not think Xerxes would react the way that he did. But he was a bit of a hothead. This is what Herodotus said about Xerxes. Just one story of many I could give you. While trying to invade Greece in a couple of months, Xerxes tried to build a bridge across the Hellespont. And so, as the bridge was completed, a storm came up and washed it away. He was so angry that Herodotus says, and I quote, "Xerxes flew into a rage at this and commanded that the Hellespont be struck with 300 lashes of the whip, and that a pair of foot chains be thrown into the sea as though to bind it. It has even been said that he sent off a rank of branders along with the rest of the Hellespont. He also commanded the scourgers to speak outlandish and arrogant words. You hateful water! Our master lays his judgment on you thus, for you have unjustly punished them, even though he's done no wrong. Xerxes the king will pass over you whether you like it or not. It is fitting that no man offer you sacrifices because you're a muddy and salty river." And then he had the engineers' heads cut off. Xerxes was not what you would call a level-headed kind of guy. And he was drunk, sins for his wife, she won't come. Now, picture the context here. He's trying to persuade all of his gathered nobles that he's the man to capture Greece. He's the man to lead this grand army. He is the ultimate commander. And then his wife won't do what he says. PR disaster. And so Xerxes summons his counselors, what should I do? And they say, simple, you should banish your wife from your presence forever. Boom! She's exiled. And Xerxes goes off to invade Greece. It does not go so well. You may remember a little battle called Thermopylae, where 300 Spartans held off a full army of Persians. And then a couple other stuff happened, not so good. And Xerxes goes back a few years later in total defeat, totally bummed out, gets home, no wife waiting for him, and he begins to go into a funk in his palace. His advisors come up to him and says, "Oh king, have you forgotten how good it is to be king?" And he's like, "What do you mean?" He's like, "Look, you're the king. What you should do, you don't have a wife now, but this is more of an advantage than a disadvantage. You should have a beauty pageant throughout the entire kingdom and find all the most beautiful unmarried women and have sex with them. And then the ones that you like best, keep in your harem, and the one you like best of all, make your queen." And he's like, "It is good to be king. I will do this. You speak wisely. You get a promotion." And so he does this. And so all these young women, whether willing or not, probably most not willing, are hauled off to become members of his harem. Now, Esther is one such woman who's gathered up in this roundup. She's probably just a beautiful girl walking down the street, and one of the king's envoys saw her and said, "You in the wagon now." Now, she was extraordinarily gorgeous and also unmarried. From that we can infer, and also given the age of marriage then, she's probably very young. In fact, probably younger than most of you. Think of yourself maybe 2 years ago, 2.5 to 3 years ago, to think of when she likely was age-wise. Young girl, hauled off to have sex with a man she's never met, lose her virginity, whether she likes him or not, and if he doesn't like her, regardless of how she feels about him, she gets stuck into a room where she only gets to talk to women for the rest of her life and never sees another man. She's probably not really excited about this whole beauty pageant thing, but she gets, and so just think, how nervous would you be in her shoes? I'd be pretty darn freaked out. That would really mess with my head a lot. So she's hauled off, and her uncle, or cousin rather, Mordecai, gives her this advice. Don't tell anybody that you're a Jew. That might throw things for a curve, so don't tell anybody you're a Jew. She's like, okay. She goes. She gets a very interesting reception when she arrives. she begins to have this little thing called favor occurring to her at every time that she turns around. If you don't know what the word favor means, it's the biblical equivalent of the word cool or accepted. She shows up, and it says several times in the text that Esther found favor. She found favor with the chief eunuch. She found favor with the king. She found favor with everybody that she met. Now, think of yourself when you were in late adolescence as a teenager. How important was it for you to feel accepted when you were feeling greatly anxious, nervous, and stressed out and self-conscious? I feel like most teenagers, it was probably the dominant driving force in your life. This craving to fit in somewhere. This craving to belong. This craving to be thought of as cool by someone, preferably by a lot of people. And most hopefully of all, by the people you yourself thought were cool. Does this sound familiar to anybody? Give you some flashbacks? Hopefully good ones. Side note here. C.S. Lewis wrote a brilliant essay. Actually, I guess I should say he gave a brilliant speech, which was later transcribed as an essay, called The Inner Ring. Has anybody here ever read The Inner Ring, the essay by C.S. Lewis? I think it's probably C.S. Lewis's best short work. I'm going to put a link to it on our website tonight, and I'll also send it out to the Kyle for discussion list. So if you're not on that, please be sure to sign up at the end of the evening. Send out the essay tonight. It's very short, maybe 4,000 words. Acutely insightful. He gave it to a group of students just like you. He was invited to lecture the master's lecture at 1944 at King's College in London. And he got up and he began to speak to these young people. And he gave them this advice. He said, and I quote, that it is his conviction that in everyone's life at some point, and in most people's lives, in some people's lives at all periods, between infancy and extreme old age, one of the most dominant elements is a desire to be inside the inner circle and the terror of being left outside. Now, what circle it is that matters to us changes radically from person to person. See, there's people who think that they don't have this in them at all, but they have their own circle. Some people, they want to be inside the circle that's making decisions in whatever group it is. Others want to be inside the circle that's maybe helping set things up and acting behind the scenes. Others want to be inside the circle that's kind of cool and alternative and funky, and they don't really feel like they're acting like anybody else, but you look at them, they all dress the same in their alternative weirdness. It's like the goth movement. To be individual, they all dress like one another. Now, if you're a goth, which none of you seem to be looking around, I don't belittle that. Everyone does that to a certain extent. C.S. Lewis, acutely insightful in this essay, talks about how it is that this is intrinsically a neutral thing, that we seek to have friends and we seek to hang out with people who are like us and with whom we like common things. But like many neutral things, the desire for it can taint us. Example. Let's say that your great aunt dies and leaves you $1 million. You're sorry she died, but you're gratified to get the $1 million. Anything wrong with that? No, not at all. That's normal. Your great aunt is sick. You help her die so you can get $1 million. Much, much worse. The law takes a much dimmer view of that second. Why? Because even though the thing itself is neutral, her death and you receiving an inheritance, you pursuing it can mess you up on the inside in a major way. Same thing with trying to get inside the inner circle, whatever the circle is. When we seek to curry favor with people, when we seek to be cool, all too often, we begin to betray who we are in order to fit in with them more. And anybody who's ever tried to get in with a group that didn't accept you right away, you know what I'm talking about. You've seen it in other people's lives, and you probably experienced it in your own. This just slight hedging of who you are and what you value. And C.S. Lewis goes on to point out that this is how good people become twisted and horrible monsters, by consistently walking down this road again and again and again. Now, Esther, I think it's clear from the text, is starting off on this road. How do I know that? Because she's not living out her faith. How can I tell? Well, it's very simple. First, Esther shows no qualms at all in marrying a Gentile. She didn't try and pray and get out of it at all. Any indication in the text that she in any way tried to avoid that, even though it was really considered a very negative thing in the Bible. She did not follow the directive of Daniel and his friends. Daniel, 100 years earlier, brought into captivity. How long did he have until he had to choose whether to make a stand or not? Until his first meal. Less than 24 hours on site, and Daniel and his friends are like, we will not eat this food. It violates our dietary laws. Esther? None of that. She's like, woo, bring it on. Sweets, I like those. Bonbons. Most tellingly, though, no one knew Esther was a Jew. No one, even her husband, did not know she was a Jew. Now, when you're eating a special diet, that would be very difficult. But it's even more difficult when you're obeying the Jewish ritual calendar. For example, observing the Feast of Passover. Pretty essential to be a Jew, right? Hard to hide that one. Honey, what's that you're painting over the doorpost? Blood. Why? Oh, no reason. Honey, what are you doing down there in the courtyard? Building a tent. Why? The second best bed in the entire kingdom, the one that I sleep in, just isn't comfortable for me anymore. I'd rather sleep on the hard, rocky ground of the courtyard in this booth to celebrate the Feast of Booths. There's no way that she was living as an observant Jew if no one knew that she was a Jew. Esther was going along to get along. She simply wasn't identifying with her God or with her people. I think the reason that she did this, just based on people that I know, on human nature, on just some reflection and some reading, not based on a specific text in the Bible. I want to be clear about that. This is my interpretation. It's because she found it so easy to gain favor in people's eyes. Because Esther was a hottie. She was beautiful. Everyone loved her. Women wanted to be her. Men wanted to be with her, as the old saying goes. And she was able to take solace in her extraordinarily good looks. As far as we can tell, the best looks in the entire kingdom. Have you ever known someone like that, who was so good looking that they just couldn't get off of themselves? All they could do was think about how good looking they were. And how everybody else, they just expected them to do things for them because, hey, they're special. Because they have a finely chiseled jaw or an exceptionally ample bosom or whatever particular piece of anatomy would be relevant in their case. Esther began to derive her security and her significance from her good looks and from the way that people related to her rather than from her faith and from her God. Security and significance. I've said this before in this meeting and I'll say it many times again. You can always tell where you're going to find trouble in your Christian life. Anything that you derive your significance and security from, whatever gives you those things, is almost certainly going to, at one point or another in your life, become a rival for God's affections. It will become an idol to you. And you will, in turn, worship it. You will give it yourself. It doesn't matter whether it's grades, or whether it's favor, coolness, getting in with a certain crowd, or it's a person, a particularly attractive someone whom you just are dying to have in your life. A car, whatever it is that gives you your sense of significance and your sense of security is going to become a rival for God's affections in your life. It will become, if you do not watch it carefully, an idol. Esther had an idol, and her idol was herself. The good news is I work for myself. The bad news is my boss is a horrible pile-driving jerk. We make cruel masters. We make cruel masters. And then a crisis came. Haman, for some reason, and we think we know why, did not get along with Esther's cousin, Mordecai. They hated one another, in fact. Haman hated Mordecai because Mordecai would not bow to Haman. We can infer that Mordecai hated Haman because he would not bow. See, Mordecai bowed to people. It wasn't a thing like, I will not bow because I'm a Jew. It wasn't that at all. Many observant and religious Jews in the Old Testament bowed to other people, not to worship, but just to express honor in the same way that I might stand and applaud after someone important gives a speech. That was not the issue. Haman was an Amalekite. That was the first group of people who attacked Israel when they were freed from their slavery. And they became, sort of in the Old Testament, the emblem of anti-Semitism and of hatred of the Jews. They came to stand in for all the powers that were arrayed against God's chosen people. And so Mordecai probably is thinking, I'm not bowing to this guy. He's an Amalekite. I hate him. It would be just like, It would be like today, Yasser Arafat having a Jew working for him in the PLO. There's going to be some awkward conversations around the old coffee cups there. It's not going to go very well. So Mordecai and Haman, they hate one another. Eventually drives Haman into such a rage that he tricks the king into authorizing the genocide of all Jewish people in the empire. And since the empire covered the physical nation of Israel, that would mean the genocide of all Jewish people, except for a few, like a handful, who maybe were in far-off lands. And so Mordecai thinks and he runs to Esther. And he says, Esther, you're the queen. You're the only one the king might listen to. We need you to go. Let him know you're a Jew and let him know that unless he does something, you're going to be killed like everybody else. And then Esther has a decision to make. She has to choose where will she put her sense of security. where will she put her trust? She can do one of two things. She can either be like, man, I don't know you. Guards, guards, get this crazy Jew away from me. And try to play it out in the king's palace. She is the queen. Maybe no one will figure out she's a Jew. Perhaps. But probably in an empire that size, at least someone knows. And someone's going to rat her out. But she can maybe trust in the king's leniency or something. Or she could trust in God's protection. You see, there's another problem. If she goes to the king uninvited, and he's not had sex with her for 30 days. He's been visiting the harem quite a bit. So she's thinking she's on the outs, like Vashti. This is not a man known for his faithfulness. If she's out of favor, she's another toy that he's going to throw aside, she just might be put to death. Because if you enter the king's presence without his invitation, no matter who you are, you get put to death in the Persian Empire. Unless the king gives you special, special grace. So she's like, will I trust that God will protect me with this hothead? Another thing King Xerxes did, give you another sense of how cruel this man could be. One of his staunchest supporters and biggest bankrollers, a guy who was going to pay the equivalent of a couple $1 million into the treasury to help fund this expedition to Greece. He says, O king, I have given you all this money. I've also sent all 5 of my sons to serve in your military. Please, sir, I'm an old man. Could my eldest son stay with me and help me in my old age while you go off to war, while my other 4 serve alongside you? Xerxes was so annoyed at that request that he said, that's it. The only reason I'm not killing you is because you just gave me a lot of money. But that son you love so much, I'm cutting him in half right now. He cut him in half and had his army march off to war between the two halves. A very, very messed up man. I mean, you read the text. Haman says, hey, I want to kill a bunch of people in your empire. Sure. I don't care who they are. Just go do it. He gives him the ring that gives him full authority. Xerxes is not a level-headed man. She's thinking, I'm going to walk into this hothead's place where the default is I die unless he intervenes. Who will I trust? Will I trust in my current status with him, gained by my favor and my good looks, or will I trust that God will protect me? She has a choice to make. Will she publicly identify as a believer? And that is the choice I want to talk about tonight for each of us. So often at Stanford, we are tempted to not publicly identify as believers, to not publicly be Christians with Christ. We tell ourselves all sorts of things. For instance, it's really a personal thing anyway with me and God. It's not so important that other people know where I stand on this. I don't want to be a Jesus freak. I don't want to be obnoxious. Don't want to be pushy. Don't want to be weird. Don't want to be intrusive. Don't want to be intolerant. Don't want to be fill in the blank. And so I'll just let this ride. And the less they know about my faith, the less likely they are to make assumptions about me, unfavorable assumptions about me, about my intelligence, about how much fun I might be to hang out with, about how cool I am, about whether or not I'm worthy to be in their circle. Publicly identifying with Christ is a really big deal. It's a really big deal in the Bible. In fact, Jesus only gave us 2 rituals to practice. One was communion, where we celebrate with one another, indicating the importance of togetherness and community. We've got to be together to celebrate communion. The second is baptism. Baptism is not something that saves you or makes you a Christian. Baptism is the public identification of your life with Jesus's. That's why it's so important. You're saying, I'm going to live like just like Jesus. And to symbolically demonstrate that, I'm going to do something that he did for no other reason than that he did it. I will publicly become like him. Also, there's more symbolism about death and resurrection in there. But fundamentally, it's about public identification with Christ. Jesus has some strong words to say about publicly identifying with him. He says, next slide, if anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of him when he comes in his Father's glory with the holy angels. It's sort of made a little bit more clear in Matthew 10, 32 and 33, as if that was not clear enough. If anyone acknowledges me publicly here on earth, I will openly acknowledge that person before my Father in heaven. But if anyone denies me here on earth, I will deny that person before my Father in heaven. You can't be a Christian unless you're willing to publicly identify with Jesus. And I mean that very literally. You cannot be a Christian. You are not a Christian. It means you don't have... This is not a work that makes you a Christian. This is evidence of the commitment of your faith, the level of your faith. If you don't have the the level of faith to publicly identify as a believer, you don't have the level of faith requisite for salvation. You are not a Christian if you're ashamed of Jesus. Now, you might wrestle with being ashamed of Jesus, and I'm not trying to heap guilt upon you. It's something we all wrestle with from time to time because we live in a place where it's not cool to be a Christian. It's not cool to have faith. It's not cool to believe in certain situations and with certain people. But if your default is you're living a covert Christian life, you come to maybe Chi Alpha and you live one way, and then you go back out into your classes, into the dorms, around the cafeteria, and you live a totally different way, I would really ask you to examine yourself and to ask yourself about the extent of your commitment to Christ and your faith. What are some ways that we can publicly identify with Christ? What are some ways that we could test ourselves to see whether or not we're actually ashamed of Him in practice or not? Well, first, be baptized. If you haven't been baptized, it's a big deal. You should do it. Talk to me after. Second, stop censoring yourself. What do I mean by that? Something I've noticed in my life and in the lives of many Christians that I listen to is we talk differently around Christians than we do around non-Christians. Now, some of that's a little bit normal. Like, you know, there's some buzzwords that maybe don't make sense to people outside of our little circle, and so we kind of use them as shorthand, and then we use a more full phrase when we're talking with someone else. But we'll also censor content. Let me give you an example. Hey, Karen, I've got such a great testimony. You remember how I wanted to go to Winter Conference, and I didn't have the money. I was praying, and I just was praying, God, please give me the money if you want me to go. Well, I got a check for the exact amount that I need. Isn't that great? Praise God. Woo-hoo! You go back to your dorm room. Hey, Glenn, what are you so excited about? Oh, I got this check in the mail, and I really needed the money. It was great. Hear the difference between those two? I prayed, and God answered my prayer. Something nice happened to me. Woo, that's great. We censor ourselves. Another. Picture John and Andrew talking to one another. John's talking to Andrew. Hey, how was your weekend? Andrew, pretty good. Oh, what was so good about it? Well, man, I checked out this new church for the first time this Sunday. It rocked. I had such a great time at, fill in your favorite church, Highway, Abundant Life, Menlo Prez, what have you. It rocked. It just made my whole weekend. You go to class. Hey, man, you seem like you're in a good mood. Yeah, I had a pretty good weekend. What happened? Oh, you know, had some moments with friends, hung out, did some good things. You don't play the church card. Why not? Because you're ashamed to mention that you went to church. You're worried about how would they judge you, think about you, feel about you. You censor yourself. You're trying to schedule a study group session. Someone suggests Wednesday at 8. You say, I have a meeting then. Versus, I'm sorry, I have a Christian worship service I go to then. It's kind of important to me. We can meet afterwards. If you'd like, you're welcome to come with me. Or we can we get together before and you come with me. Or we can get together afterwards. No big deal. But I really don't think I can meet then. All the difference in the world between those two responses. One feels free to identify with Christ and Christians. One tries hard to conceal the fact that they're a Christian. So the second thing after baptism is stop censoring yourself. Be authentic, no matter who you're with. Say what you're thinking. Now, maybe again, you can shift your language some to be understandable. That's just sanity. That's good communication. But stop filtering your content. You could, for instance, hang a Christian poster on your door or some Christian decoration in your room. You don't have to. I'm just saying these are ways you could. If you have a little whiteboard, you could draw a little Ichthus Jesus fish. You could do something. It just sort of pushes you out enough, not in an obnoxious way, not some weird, bizarre thing, like turning the antechamber to your dorm room into a vision of hell. And then, you don't have to do any of that. No necessarily goat's blood over your door or whatever. But you could just begin to identify slightly more publicly, slightly more aggressively. And by aggressive, I don't mean obnoxious, but just people don't have to dig it out of you. They have to avoid noticing. You put it as a default, they will know you're a Christian, rather than a default, they will have to guess. You just put some Christian books in a visible place in your room instead of like buried beneath your mattress like they were Playboys or something. Which, by the way, if you have Playboys there, just go ahead and get rid of those. Finally, you could actually speak from a faith perspective in class from time to time. This is a big one. And this can be dangerous and risky. I'm not proposing it lightly. And obviously, it will change from class to class. Like math class, hard to raise a real faith perspective in there. Well, professor, I was just wondering, isn't it possible this formula's got two interpretations, one depending on whether you believe in God or not? Not so much. Y equals 2x regardless. But in sociology, anthropology, art, history, most of the humanities, anything fuzzy, psychology, there will at least once or twice in the course of a quarter, usually more than that, arise a chance in the course of the classroom discussion. I'm not talking about being intrusive and like interrupting your professor. But in the course of when people are just talking, And you have a chance, like everybody else, to throw in your two bits. To throw in your two bits in a respectful and reasonable way. Now, what that will look like will vary from discipline to discipline. It will vary from person to person. But you should not be ashamed or afraid to do it. If, for instance, you think your professor is misrepresenting something, or usually they're not maliciously misrepresenting something, although some do. They're just ignoring something because of a bias that they have. For instance, they make some allusion, A-L-L, not I-L-L, an allusion to some biblical story. And they say, of course, there's no historical evidence for that. And people talk, you can just say, you mean no other historical evidence, don't you? What do you mean? Well, I'm sorry, I hope this isn't weird, professor, but if I understand you right, you don't believe the Bible is the Word of God or anything, do you? Oh, no, of course not. So you believe it's a historical document. So we do have some historical evidence for what you said. The question is, how credible or reliable is that evidence? Now, that's not aggressive, that's not obnoxious. You can do it reasonably and respectfully, but you can also, you can begin to show how your faith makes a difference in the way you look at things. Psychology. Or, you know, a criminal justice class. Probably don't have this here. A social justice class. Well, doesn't it make a difference whether you believe that people are fundamentally good or fundamentally bad? Well, yeah. Well, we all believe people are fundamentally good in here, though, don't we? I think the record's more mixed. I think we have the capacity for greatness in us. But I think also probably the most well-established principle in the history of humanity is that people, we tend towards badness more than we tend towards goodness. You may disagree with that, but it's something I believe pretty deeply, and I'm pretty committed to it. We can talk about it. But that's a faith perspective that you're bringing up. You're not even necessarily always latching it back to the Bible, but you're letting your beliefs be known. And you're letting them be known in a reasonable and an honest way, just like everybody else in the class, hopefully. Hopefully you come off looking like the most reasonable one in the class because of the way in which you do it, but you do it consistently. People will notice. They got into Stanford. They're not idiots. They'll pick up, and you will have opportunities to chat with them about your faith at some point or another. So Esther, she comes to this crisis mode. Will she publicly identify with her people, with her faith, with her God, or not? In the story, she does, and the Jewish people are saved. And so we are saved today. Because they were saved, Jesus came. Because Jesus came, we have eternal life. You never know when publicly identifying with your faith can make all the difference in the world. Maybe for a group of people, maybe for just one person. But you never know what a difference it can make if you choose not to be ashamed. I don't know tonight what it is that you might wrestle with. What it is that you might cling to that would cause you to desire it more than your relationship with Christ. I'm pretty sure for everyone in this room, there's something that's at least a potential rival, even if not a currently active one. For most of us, it's probably got something to do with our intellect, our grades, our perceived self-competence. For some of us, probably our good looks. That's a category I put myself into, of course. I don't know what it is. Your cool car, you know, whatever it is that makes you such a hip dude or gal. But whatever it is that gives you your sense of security and significance, tonight I'm challenging you to deliberately lay that on the altar before God and to tell God, if I have to choose between this and you, I choose you. I always choose you.